This is the second day of this October 2008 seven-day session. And we'll return to the teachings of the Chan Master Da Hui, reading from the text Swampland Flowers. And the subtitle is The Letters and Lectures of Zen Master Da Hui. This is this one is clearly a letter to one of his disciples, a secretary, Lu. And Da Hui says, "Since we parted, I don't know whether or not you can avoid being carried away by external objects in your daily activities as you respond to circumstances. Whether or not you can put aside your heap of legal documents as you look through them, whether or not you can act freely when you meet with people, whether or not you engage in vain thinking when you're where it's peaceful and quiet, whether or not you are thoroughly investigating this matter without any distracted thoughts." So this, again, is the indirect Chinese way of probing, of saying, can you avoid being carried away by external objects? Can you put aside your heap of legal documents as you look through them? Can you act freely when you meet with people? But he starts off with, "I don't know whether or not you can," so forth. There's one that's particularly interesting formulation here. I wonder whether you can put aside your heap of legal documents as you look through them. What does that mean? It means being so absorbed in the involvement with the legal documents in this case. You're so absorbed in it that it's as if they're not there. There's no object separate from oneself as a subject. This is a kind of samadhi. He's asking whether he can maintain, whether this secretary Lu can maintain his samadhi in daily life and in activity. Because when we are 100% absorbed in what we're doing, it's as though there's no doing. When you're 100% absorbed while eating, absorbed just in the eating, then it's what in Zen we call no eating. When you're in conversation with someone and you're thoroughly in conversation, the mind is undivided, then that's no speaking. It reminds me of something that has often been asked to me, which is by people who say that they feel that they're really engaged in their daily life with their job, with their family. But then hours can pass when they don't have a single thought of their koan, let's say mu. And what I always say to such people is that, well, yeah, it would be great if you could be absorbed in mu continuously, whatever you're doing. But short of that, the key thing is to be fully engaged and to be without a divided mind. This is really the essence of Zazen, of Zen practice, is with being without a divided mind. So if in these other circumstances, even though the mu, or whatever your practice is, even though you're not aware of it, at least if you're really thoroughly engaged, while listening to someone speak, to just listen. While working at your computer, to just be doing that 100%. When playing golf, to just be thoroughly into that. This is, in a way, this is the whole point of practice, is to reach this degree of oneness, non-separation with whatever we're doing. It's not quite as good as having the mu in your awareness as you're doing these things, because the koan is needs to be resolved, and it needs to be resolved by addressing it directly, questioning it. But this is the next best thing. You're not going far afield, far wrong, when you're absorbed in whatever you're doing, even though you don't have the koan in mind. Let's look at some more of these. Whether or not you can act freely when you meet with people. Well, what would obstruct our acting freely? Well, self-consciousness. That's the divided mind again. Whether or not you engage in vain thinking when you are where it's peaceful and quiet. So many of us can make a decent performance of being empty and free and fluid and without the fetters of thought when we're with others, around others, but in private, when we're alone in our room, alone outside, everything is nice and quiet, then it's more difficult to avoid giving way to thoughts of self-concern. Vain thinking doesn't just mean concern about your appearance. In Zen texts, vanity is really sort of the same as egoistic. Or we could say that until enlightenment, we all have some degree of narcissism. Houston Smith, in his book that he co-authored called simply Buddhism, a superb introduction to the different kinds of different streams of Buddhism, in alluding to this narcissism that is part of virtually everyone, he asks the question, when you look at a group photo that you're in, who's the first person you look at? Dawi continues, thus old Yellowface, which is, he's referring to the Buddha, has said, when the mind does not vainly grasp at past things, does not long for things in the future, and does not dwell on anything in the present, then you realize fully that the three times are all empty and still. The three times, past, present, and future, are all empty and still. They're empty of any substance. These notions of past, present, and future are just that, notions, constructs we've come up with to divide time for the sake of convenience. But ultimately, these three are just thoughts. Right now, Where's the past? Where is it? I don't see it anywhere. I don't hear it. How about the future? Nope, not that either. How about the present? Well, even to call it present implies that there's some other time, past or future. Ultimately, these three terms are without any substance to them, any real meaning to them. And then Da Wei comments on these words of the Buddha. He says, you shouldn't think about past events, whether good or bad. If you think, that obstructs the path. You shouldn't consider future events. To consider them is crazy confusion. Present events are right in front of you. Whether they're pleasant or unpleasant, don't fix your mind on them. If you do fix your mind on them, it will disturb your heart. Just take everything in its time, responding according to circumstances, and you will naturally accord with this principle, with the way, the Tao. Now, he knows very well, Da Wei, that there are times when we need to make plans, set schedules. There are times when we need to recall something from the past. But these are really very, very seldom that we have to do these things. Most of our reverting into past events and past things are unnecessary. It's just habit. Just chewing over memories, things that someone has done or said, or I've done or said. Same with the future. How much planning do we really need to do? Very little. The rest is just useless ruminating about the future, fretting, rehearsing. This is all a waste of time. There are always some people in Sesshin, maybe everyone to some extent, but there's some people in particular who come into Sesshin trailing some vivid things that have happened to them, either in a relationship or something at work. And they find it difficult to shake this stuff that clings to them, to the mind. Well, but this is the way it is. How many people can be free of such concerns completely when they come into Sesshin? Very few. But then, all right, so we have this stuff adhering to the mind when we begin Sesshin. But then, of course, the key thing is not to dwell in these things. Well, people say, I know, I don't want to dwell in those things. But you do have some choice in the matter. Don't play helpless. Oh, what can I do? This is a big thing. Well, you can start chipping away at getting back to the practice, which is just a way of getting back to the present. The practice is just a portal to the present. And your mind slips off again and again and again. Well, just keep bringing it back. Don't compound the problem by thinking about your thinking about the past and the future. Something really major, like your wife just notified you as you're going to Sesshin that she wants a divorce, or you just found out that you lost all your money in your bank account, something like that. This may not go away completely in Sesshin. But even big things, if you're really applying yourself to your practice, these things can disappear from the mind for periods of time. At the very least, after a few days, certainly, these things will recede. They just get more faint. And you can find yourself suddenly noticing them and being surprised at how you did manage to get past them for a while. It's all a matter of commitment to the practice. Do you want to waste time in Sesshin sifting through these things that happened before or that will happen after? Do you want to do that, or do you want to see through them? Everyone can do this. You can see that they're there, but they're not there. They're a part of your life, but somehow, in a very real way, they're not. We don't have to labor under these fetters. Most people who have something significant on their mind when they come to Sesshin, they go back and forth somewhat. They get free of it some, then they crash into it again and get swept away by these thoughts, and then they shake it off for a while, and then it comes back. But overall, over the course of these days, these things lose their grip on the mind, little by little, sometimes all at once. I think part of it is acknowledging that thinking about these things isn't really going to help. How much thinking about them can you do? I hear this from people. I know it from my own experience. Okay, you've thought about and thought about it and thought about it and thought about it in every which way and every angle and up and down and trying to understand why. Let go of it. At some point, you just have to see that that's not really going to deliver you from the issue. It's really not going to help you get through it. What will help you get through it is refraining from that involvement with those things and just diving deep into the practice and the practice alone and nothing else. If you do that, then okay, when you come out of Sesshin, you may have to face the same issue. It's not like a magic wand that the thing goes away, but you will have a different perspective on it. You will see it differently. And that's the key thing, isn't it? It's not just the problem itself as something outside us. There is no outside us. There is no problem that's a pure abstraction. It's the way we engage with it, the way we relate to it. And that is being changed simply by having this one-pointed, single-minded absorption in the practice without directly getting involved with thoughts about the thing. So that's past and future. And then he says, present events are right in front of you, whether they're pleasant or unpleasant, don't fix your mind on them. I know this was a mistake that I made early in practice, and I see it in other people, where you think, okay, being present means as you're walking along is to note things. Okay, there's a table, there's a floor, there's the fixture, there's a tree, there's a squirrel. This is just a running commentary in the mind. That's That's fixing the mind on them. In Zen, it's not a matter of labeling or being self-conscious about whether or not you're present. It's just it's much more adequately expressed in terms of what not to do. It's or what's absent. What's absent is the mediation of thoughts. When you see a tree, it's not a thought of a tree, but just you don't need a word for the direct experience. In fact, the word comes between, gets in the way of the direct experience. It's just the pure perception. No words, no thoughts. It's the pure experience of the drinking, the tasting, the seeing, the smelling, the touching, the hearing. Not trying to put the mind on them, but rather noticing any thoughts about them. Now one is already separated from the direct experience. Noticing and then dropping them. Or that's if your practice in the Zendo is breath practice, then you just drop any thoughts as you notice them. If the practice is a koan, you just return the mind to the koan. He goes on, unpleasant situations are easy to handle. Pleasant situations are hard to handle. For that which goes against one's will, that's the unpleasant, it boils down to one word, patience. Settle down and reflect a moment, and in a little while, it's gone. It's pleasant situations that truly give you no way to escape. Like pairing magnet and iron, unconsciously, this and that come together in one place. Even inanimate objects are thus. How much the more so for those acting in ignorance with their whole beings making a living within it. So, yeah, he makes a good point here, is that adversity, unpleasant circumstances, we can reflect on them, we can remind ourselves that they will pass, we can employ cognitive devices, just little ways of detaching from these difficult experiences, circumstances. But the pleasant ones, no one wants to detach from pleasant experiences. You just want to relish them, whether it's thoughts about sense pleasures or other things. He goes on, in this world, if you have no wisdom, you will be dragged unknowing and unaware by that ignorance into a net. Once inside the net, won't it be difficult to look for a way out? This is why an early sage said, having entered the world, leave the world completely. What's this mean? Having entered the world, leave the world completely. By becoming so one with one's life, this is a way to be free of it. This is the paradox that lies within any ultimate truth. In Zen, we see this again and again. The closest we can come to expressing truth in words is through paradox. Another way it's been put is to be in the world but not of the world. And it comes down to detachment. Sometimes the word detachment is used in a negative way, like disengagement or separation. But in Zen and Buddhism, detachment is the thing. To have some, it really is the same as presence of mind, not to be so caught up in the story that we lose perspective, not to be so caught up in the melodrama of what's happening that we lose perspective. And the good news is that detachment is a byproduct of long zazen. We will surely find, as time goes on in our practice, that we weather challenges better by finding some detachment in the midst of them. Having entered the world, leave the world completely. In a very limited and superficial sense, we can say that this is what we do in Sesshin. We, without becoming celibate monks, we still take the occasional week or so and leave the world behind, enter this seclusion. But really, that is just for the purpose of developing the detachment that enables us, when we leave, to be free of the bondage of worldly concerns. Anyone can leave the world by disappearing and holding yourself up somewhere and not talking, but the real seclusion is to move through one's daily life, one's busy daily life, with this detachment, this presence of mind, not getting swept up in the things that we can get so overly concerned about. And then he quotes Vimalakirti, this great enlightened layman householder. For those with the conceit of superiority, falsely claiming attainment, the Buddha just says that detachment from greed, hatred, and delusion is liberation. Detachment from those things is liberation. For those with no conceit of superiority, the Buddha says that the inherent nature of greed, hatred, and delusion is identical to liberation. And that's the end of Vimalakirti's statement. This points to the Zen emphasis on accommodating the teaching to the listener. Words can be used in so many different ways that to one person who's at one level of practice, you can use words in a certain way, and to someone else at a different level, you use them differently. And in each case, it may be the perfect thing for them to hear. Here, you notice the difference here with those who are falsely claiming attainment. He says that the emphasis is on detachment from greed, hatred, and delusion. And with those without that kind of attachment, then you could say that it's the very nature of greed, hatred, and delusion that is not separate from liberation. Well, this is something that takes awakening to really understand this. He goes on, Dawi comments on Vimalakirti's statement, if you can avoid this fault so that in the midst of situations favorable or adverse, there is no aspect of origination or demise, birth or death, only then can you get away from the name conceit of superiority applied to one who thinks he has attained but hasn't. Only this way can you be considered to have entered the world and be called a person of power. What I've been talking about thus far is all my personal life experience. Even right now, I practice just like this. I hope that you will take advantage of your physical strength and health and also enter this stable equilibrium. Take advantage of your physical strength and health, such as it is, because we know that as the decades pass, it will decline. Young people will just have to take this on faith. Those of us who are older have seen this decline, see the additional aches and pains that come with aging. No matter what pain we had earlier, when young, the body just gradually deteriorates. And the health may stay strong later, late in life, but still, who knows when we might suddenly be afflicted with some disease or something that, just in the most, to put it the most obvious way, something that prevents us from coming to Sesshin. Our tendency, I think this is fair to say, the human tendency is to assume that things will go on as they have been. That there will be more sesshins on into the future, but we don't know this, do we? And then another letter. This is to a Tsong Chan Yu. Having read your letter carefully, I have come to know that you are unremitting in your conduct, that you are not carried away by the press of official duties, that in the midst of swift-flowing streams, you vigorously examine yourself. Far from being lax, your aspiration to the path grows ever more firm as time goes on. You have fulfilled my humble wishes solidly and profoundly. Now I wonder, will he stop there or will he bring up something else? Nevertheless, worldly passions are like a blazing fire. When will they ever end? Right in the midst of the hubbub, you mustn't forget the business of the bamboo chair and reed cushion. This is what they used commonly in ancient China. They would sit in certain. Well, I'll just speak from what I saw when I was at Bodhidharma's temple in China, Shaolin Temple, and we were granted permission to go to the morning sitting there with the monks, and to our astonishment, what they sat on were not tons, not the floor, not mats, but wicker, like stools, concave stools. I think they sell them at Pier 1, these kind of things. Not from Shaolin, but they're round at the top, and they're circular, and they have kind of an hourglass shape. You've seen these. So you sort of have to scramble up on this little hourglass-shaped thing that's sunken in the middle and do your best. And wicker, straw, bamboo, frame, maybe. That's what he's talking about is Zazen, sitting right in the midst of the hubbub, right in the midst of our busy lives. You mustn't forget the business of the bamboo chair and the reed cushion. And what he really means is, in the midst of your life, even without sitting, find a way. You mustn't forget this being in the world but not of the world, this detachment, this mind of stability, of stable awareness. That's really the deeper meaning of sitting. It doesn't just mean literally sitting with your back straight in a certain posture, but it means carrying this mind of stabilized awareness throughout one's business. He goes on, usually to meditate, you set your mind on a still concentration point, but you must be able to use it right in the midst of the hubbub. If you have no strength amidst commotion, after all, it's as if you never made any effort in stillness. Well, this is hard won, what he's talking about. This is not beginner stuff. This takes most of us a good deal of time, years, to develop this ability to maintain this no-minded awareness in the turmoil of our daily life, the stress, the meetings, the conversations, the quarrels we may get into, the decision-making, the difficult decisions, the dilemmas we face, the noise, the commuting to work and back, the all of the churning that is the daily life of most everyone these days. And so we just have to persist. We have to be patient. We've got ourselves into this fix of being pulled apart in all directions. We've been doing this for so long. Lifetimes and lifetimes of being scattered, that now we can't just reverse that because we want to. It takes time. He goes on, I have heard that there was some complicated situation in the past, and now you are experiencing the sadness of the outcome. Alone, you do not dare to hear your fate. If you arouse this thought, then it will obstruct the path. An ancient worthy said, if you can recognize the inherent nature while going along with the flow, there is neither joy nor sorrow. This is called equanimity, neither joy nor sorrow, but an evenness, an even detachment. Some people will hear this and be put off by it. Well, right, I mean, I don't want the sorrow for sure, but joy, give me some joy. That, it's a package deal, you know. You got to take them both or neither one. Joy here meaning a wild kind of ecstatic, uncentered joy. But when that joy, as well as the sorrow, are when we're beyond them, then there is a different kind of quiet joy or deep, deep rest. Who would not want that? And then he quotes Vimalakirti, and this goes to the title of this book. Vimalakirti said, "It's like this. The high plateau does not produce lotus flowers. It is the mire of the low swamplands that produces these flowers." That it is by thoroughly engaging with the world, our world, on any given day, not separating ourselves from it, using it to turn the mind back to see what is beyond the ups and downs. It is by doing this that we draw most deeply from our inner resources. It's a classic image, analogy in Zen. This the fruits of really engaging with the whole person, one's whole self, and not trying to disown anything in one's mind or heart. Neither clinging to the passions, clinging to the emotions, feelings, nor denying them, blocking them, trying to disown them. Which is noticing when emotions and feelings and passions arise in the mind. Noticing, but not then getting into thoughts about. Staying on track. Not clinging to, wallowing in the emotions or feelings. Just seeing them as passing phenomena. All right, we've come to the end of our time. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.